The information presented in this podcast is not intended for the treatment or prevention of disease or any medical condition, nor is it a substitute for medical advice. The information contained herein in this podcast reflects only the opinion of the author and presenter and is in no way considered required practice.
Welcome to Motivation and Muscle, the podcast that connects your brain to your brawn.
Hi, this is Eric Fiorello, and I want to welcome you to Motivation and Muscle, the podcast show that connects your brain to your brawn. Today is August 4th, 2014, and we are sponsored by Fiorello Barbell Company here in upstate New York, where we're not the biggest, but we're the best. And our motto is, we don't try, we succeed. And today we got another brand new guest on here, which I'm very excited about, Mike Margolis of The Mental Game. Before I introduce Mike, we're going to get into, obviously, the mental topics, and this should be a very interesting show, especially if you're an athlete like myself, and also Mike does work with corporate America, too. So, Mike, welcome to Motivation and Muscle.
Thank you, Eric, for having me on.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you on. We're looking for people of your caliber. Before we get started today with the topic at hand, why don't you give everybody a little bio about yourself. You know, I'm sure the people who listen to this podcast would be very interested in what you do.
All right. As you said, my company is called The Mental Game. They can find me at themental-game.com and a lot of other places by going through the internet. But I've been working with athletes for 35 years on The Mental Game. I started out life as an athlete like yourself, only I was a little bit different because I was a failed athlete. I failed in high school in four different sports, so naturally I went and played in college. Division I college football, which I had never played tackle football before other than in the park, and quit that. But I quit going into the next season as the number one wide receiver. I just didn't know it. Then I transferred schools and I took up soccer and I played college soccer and I played a little bit of professional soccer, but I kept walking away because I didn't believe in myself. I wasn't confident. I was stressed out, but I was a good athlete. And I was blaming coaches all the time for what I couldn't do. And I went to do my master's degree to become a better coach. And lo and behold, the first person I run into who wants to hear my story starts to laugh at me because all he says is you're missing a few skills. And that was a guy by the name of Bruce Ogilvie, who's the modern father of sports psychology. And so almost immediately I got hooked and, as I say, suckered into the dark side. And so I've been working with professional athletes, world-class athletes, recreational athletes, and high school kids for the last 35 years.
That's incredible. That's a story right there. If there's a common denominator between everything from professional to, say, the backyard warriors, what is it? I mean, is it the confidence problem? What do you see as the – I mean, everybody's unique, obviously, but – is there a strand that you see with all these athletes that's very similar?
What's usually similar is that they either have difficulty handling the stress level when they move up. They have a lack of confidence in themselves. With some, especially in, you know, areas like the one that you're in with strength training and bodybuilding and weight training, it has to do with their own motivation and can they sustain themselves because of that motivation. You know, the first question, or one of the first questions, I should say, that I ask an athlete when they're either with me in my office or I'm working with them via Skype, which I work with athletes now all over the world via Skype, is, what is your purpose? What is your why? Why do you do what you do? Because most athletes don't understand what their driving motivation is for doing what they do. You know, a young person will say, well, it's fun. Well, the problem with it being fun, without that being further defined, is that there are a lot of things that are fun. So for a high school kid, you know, fun is playing sports, but then fun is getting a car, and fun is having relationships, and fun is playing on your Xbox. So there are a lot of things that are fun. What do you get out of sport? Eric, what do you get out of carrying massive rocks across?
Well, I'll tell you,
yeah. What do you get from that?
Well, I'll tell you what I get from it. I've always been a guy that likes to be tested. I don't, you know, the word fun only comes in to me when it's like we've completed it, because you have to make it fun. You got to have it loose somewhat. But I'll tell you what, the satisfaction of toying with something, this is my own feeling. I'm always like on the cusp, because this stuff, obviously, as you know, could kill you. I mean, literally. Or, you know, I did tear the bicep, like when we were talking yesterday in Iceland in 08. That was the first major injury I've ever had. And I've been playing and flaunting with some stuff for many, many years. But the thing is, with these stones, they bring out almost a barbarianism out of you. I hark back to the old world, because one thing I always thought about Iceland was you had one foot in the new world and one foot in the old world when you were there. And I kind of subscribe to that, Mike. But I can't, you know, if you know, the thing I think with athletes, and I'll even say myself, is we always usually see the end result. You know, everybody's jumping around and happy and, you know, champagne time and everything. But you're not, you know, most of the stuff you don't see what's happening, like when I'm out in this backyard like yesterday when it's 85 degrees and the humidity's dripping off you. And you're like, there are some struggle points. I mean, you know, here you are trashing yourself again to go after the biggest dream you've ever had in your life. And I think with me, it's almost an addiction. I mean, I love the stuff that much. And like, I don't know if I said it yesterday, but I had Amanda Blue on last night, and she's a competitive thrower, Highland Games and stuff, and she's kickboxed and everything. And, you know, we once again referred back to DNA. I am a firm believer, and I've had other people that have been in the strength industry and doing the same thing that believe that this is inherently born into you. There were circumstances when I started many decades ago that happened that influenced me. I do think that pushed me that way. How did I get there? I couldn't tell you. But it was something within me that wanted to start lifting weights. And it was none of the typical crap where you'll hear, well, they picked on me and I had to get stronger. Well, that happens with some people, but that wasn't the case with me. So to finally, I guess, put it to you, the question is this. I enjoy the battle. I enjoy the struggle. I enjoy the ability to defeat that stone. And I'm here to tell you, you go to Iceland, you go to Scotland, you go to Russia, you go anywhere, those stones are alive. They might not jump up and talk to you, but they are alive. They vibrate. They have energy. And the thing when you get there in a place like that, I got to tell you, whether you complete the mission the first time, the second time, the third time, there's a feeling when you wrap your arms around a stone, and this is a quote that a few people have had, but I agree with it. It's like wrapping your arms around destiny. My big thing was, who's been there before me? I mean, that goat pen's been there for over 200 years. And it's like, everybody that touched that, man, I'm touching it too. So that would be the answer. I hope, I know it was long-winded, but it is the ability to go out and take the beating and be able to beat the thing back and eventually overcome it.
See, the point is with that, and what I sense there is what another friend of mine has tagged as the fury. What is it that stirs you? And understanding that, like you do, helps you get through the training, helps you when you're competing, when you're trying to move that stone, lift that stone. That drive is the thing that you can go back to that makes you not want to stop. Most athletes, at least in the beginning, and I've worked with some even at the professional levels, they don't understand what drives them. And then when there's some adversity that comes along, whether it's a torn biceps or it's not completing the mission or it's losing, it gets harder to get back in the training room to go again. When somebody understands what drives them, then there's never a doubt about quitting or going back and not going back and starting over and figuring out another way to do something. So it starts with that.
And I agree with you totally on that because, you know, when I came back, that was pretty devastating to me to have that. And I think a lot of it was due to not proper warm-up. But you never know. Things happen. That's the way they are. And this was my first big event, and you're lifting some massive, massive stones. And, you know, you prepare, but you never know. Now I've been there two other times. I know the drill. I know how I would not, you know, I might stay in Reykjavik for the night, but I will drive and stay at the hotel in Húsafell, which has been there forever, because it's a 5-minute walk to the goat pen. And when you got to drive 2 to 2.5 hours, that's a hammering drive on you. Especially if you get lost, which we did the second time. It takes a lot out of your workout. I don't care, or out of your competition. And I don't care what anybody says. Cause you know, mentally you're a little bit stressed as you're going there. Cause you're thinking about this thing, you know, you got your gear on, whatever you got. And you put yourself in a position. And I think with this type of mental work that you're trying to complete to get these big goals, you get a little bit wiser, obviously, when you go places. And, you know, it's going to be nice to stay there and walk. I can literally walk to the goat pen. So, you know, having this success, I mean, it wouldn't stop me from going. If I was there for a week, I'd go there every day, try to lift that rock and walk 50 meters or more with it.
The one of the things that I work with athletes on is not only do you have if they're a golfer, they have a pre-shot routine. Working with you, it would be a pre-lift routine. But there's also a pre-competitive routine. It's when does competition start? Well, for almost every athlete, competition does not start when the gun goes off or you say, okay, it's time to lift this thing. It starts really the day before, the night before, and your preparation starts then. You know, and so with most athletes, I talk to them about where are you going to stay? And, you know, the younger athletes go, I don't know, wherever mom and dad say we're going to stay. And I said, well, how far is that from your competition? And they go, well, I don't know. And so if they've got to do a warm-up away from the competition like tennis players often have to do, then it's like, so where are you going to warm up? If you can't warm up there and you're an hour away, what are you going to do? Is there a park in the area? Is there tennis courts in the area? Can you go for a run at least someplace? A lot of athletes don't think about that. So your experience has taught you through trial and error, and through that 2.5-hour drive and getting lost and all that, that it would be far better for you to stay there. What I talk to athletes about is, okay, let's, before you get on the airplane to go to Iceland, what do you need to do to prepare? What do you need to do to pack? Now, I don't know what you wear, and things have changed so much because the airlines, so people are checking their suitcases so much less today. But yep. In the days when you would check everything, I would go, so you're going to go compete and you're going to check your uniform and you're going to rely on, and you're going to check your equipment and you're going to rely on the airline to actually get that stuff there. And if they don't, what happens?
Mm-hmm.
So we start all the way back before they leave. Okay. You're going to check your uniform in your carry bag. You know, you don't need clothes to be there if you're going to check the rest of your stuff, but you need whatever you need for competition. So you carry that with you, not let it out of your sight. And that's part of the preparation. What kind of food are you going to eat? If you're not used to eating whatever they eat in Iceland, you know, and I've had players go and play in Asia, and they're not used to the food. So what are you going to do when you're flying in the day before competition and this is the first time you've ever had sushi?
Yep.
So why don't you bring some things with you? How do you prepare ahead of time? And that's all part of the mental game.
Well, I always like, you know, with Iceland especially, I made sure I did have, you know, protein, obviously powder, which you got to be real careful, and I had to put that in a separate suitcase because if they go through, they'll take that. And I did have, like, you know, protein bars and things of that nature just to hold me over in case.
Right.
And what the nice thing about Iceland, when we stayed in Reykjavik, we stayed in a great place, and, you know, they had a full kitchen there and everything. And when you tell them you're going up to Húsafell to lift the stone, it's a very big deal to them. Everybody knows about that stone. And it doesn't matter what age group, because I've talked to older people that knew about it. The nice thing was the food was excellent there. They're very big with lamb. And I hadn't, you know, I always liked lamb, but I hadn't had it probably in years. My mom used to cook it sometimes on Sunday when all the family was here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they even did like a filet mignon because we got real friendly, like with the waitresses and everybody there. And it was like we'd go down and, you know, sometimes we'd go out and maybe have lunch. But normally we'd eat there. The food was dynamite. And, you know, I got to the point where I could get them to like juice for me in the morning if I wanted like wheatgrass and whatever. So we were very lucky in that respect. And I'll tell you, I didn't go one night without or one day without ever feeling hungry, you know. And it got to the point too, they had a special type of milk there, and they're like, you know, it's the fattier one and this. And so the people there, I gotta tell you too, they were the most hospitable people I think I've ever met in my life. And it wasn't any of that crap where they're trying to get tips or any of this stuff. They were genuinely very nice people.
In my travels, you know, unless you're going to a huge venue where, you know, there's other things going on, you know, most people are like that. I mean, I was, I did a seminar in December on the mental game or the game within the game in the Kingdom of Bahrain.
Wow.
And, you know, I was the first sports seminar ever in that region, in the Gulf region. And, you know, they brought me in and, you know, I'm a little bit nervous. But the people from the hotel staff to the company that brought me in to the 130 plus people that were at the seminar were all great to me. And that's the thing that most people don't understand, that, you know, that is available to you when you travel as an athlete. Most people are like that. Now, you go to the World Cup in Brazil and it's a zoo. You go to, you know, a championship someplace and it's, you know, you go to the Super Bowl I was going to say New York, but I guess it was really New Jersey, right?
Yeah, New Jersey.
You know, and you got other stuff going on because that is a really big commercial kind of event. But the athletes are taken care of. Athletes get taken care of pretty well. But that doesn't mean they can't – it doesn't mean that they don't prepare.
Oh,
and you have to prepare for that stuff. You have to have that plan because part of having the plan alleviates a lot of the stress. Because you know that, okay, if I can't get the food I need, I've got protein bars. If I can't get the whatever it is I like to, you know, if you're not just drinking water and you want to drink Powerade or Gatorade or some other kind of hydration kind of thing, you have that with you. So that planning alleviates a lot of the stress, and now you can just go and compete. And that's part of why you put this mental game plan together.
If you do, here's a question. I mean, maybe. Well, I this is what I want to ask you too. Do you have a? Is there a preference? I mean, do you get as much satisfaction out of high level athletes as you would say a high school athlete, or you know, as Rocky Balboa used to say in the first movie, a ham and egger. Is there a preference, or I mean, do you all look? Obviously, they're all different, but is there a group sometimes you find is more receptive and one you might enjoy more?
You know, they're all different. I enjoy. Okay, let me back up. So I told at the beginning, I told you my story. Mm-hmm. About failure. And the biggest disappointment really in my life is quitting football. Knowing that I don't know if I could have gone to that next level. I mean, I quit because I wasn't playing. The guy ahead of me went into the NFL as a high, wow, as a high draft pick. But I was a freshman. I had no idea that that was the reason I wasn't playing. And you know, they didn't run a very – it wasn't what you'd call a passing offense. They threw the ball 3 to 5 times a game. So I sat the bench, and I thought it was me. And, you know, the one thing that I'd want to go back and do is stick it out, because maybe there was magic there, like the coach thought there was. And, you know, he was disappointed that I was leaving. My passion today is that athletes that want to get to that next level don't quit because they're missing a skill. Don't quit because they don't know how to handle their stress. Don't quit because they're not confident because they can't handle. I had a hard time with coaches yelling at me. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't part of the way, well, in some ways it was the way I was raised, but it wasn't the way I was raised. Yep. And so I couldn't deal with that kind of mentality of people screaming at me. I mean, I once asked the head coach if I was doing anything right, because, you know, I was a rookie. I mean, I was a true rookie because I hadn't played in high school. I had to learn what a post was. I had to learn what, you know, we used to call it go this way and make a,
yeah,
you know, go up to the car and make a left, like Bill Cosby, yep, would have said. So I didn't understand those things. So I had a big learning curve. And so I asked one day at practice, Coach, am I doing anything right? And first he made me do 50 burpees, mm-hmm, for asking. And then he said, when I'm not yelling at you, you know you're doing it right. Now I got to tell you, that didn't work for me. That didn't help me understand that that was constructive criticism. I couldn't filter out the fact that somebody's yelling at me and swearing at me and in his mind trying to motivate me through that way. It just turned me off. Today I help athletes get past that. Today I help the athletes that want to get to that next level get there until their bodies or their talent won't take them any further, so that they don't have to look back at their life and say, you know, I could have been a great college football player, or maybe I could have played in the NFL. They don't have that regret, and that really makes me feel good. And that's my passion, and that's why I help people. And so whether that's, you know, I had a kid go to the World Cup this year, so I get a lot of satisfaction out of having watched him go from college to the pros to the men's U.S. national team. I started working with figure skaters a long time ago, and I had a kid that I actually tested at the Olympic Training Center, And then a year later started working with him, worked with him for a few years, and he became a 2- or 3-time world champion in figure skating. And you never know how high or how far somebody's going to go. I worked with a high school quarterback the last couple of years who's now playing in college, getting him over a back injury. The satisfaction goes from somebody getting to that next level, the kid getting a college scholarship. Some kids, it's just a matter of, you know what, I just want to play high school varsity, and I don't want to sit on the bench. I don't want to be a star. I just want to play so that everybody looks at me like I'm something, you know, depending on what their, you know, again, what their why is. But so that's, you know, the question originally was, which level do I get more satisfaction? I love working with pro athletes. Don't get me wrong. I love that. And part of that is that they have more money, so I don't have to chase them for the money. But I love working with people that are real good at what they do. I work with normal to exceptional people. In 35 years and 2,000 plus athletes that I've worked with, I've only had two that I had to refer out to a clinical psychotherapist.
Okay.
So athletes aren't as nuts as people think they are.
No, I don't think they are, Mike. And I think the thing is, I think athletes, and I think people in general that understand this a little bit, I think they're just driven. And I find with myself, with people, of course, who's going to really understand why a guy would want to go to Iceland and lift a 418-pound stone and walk 50 meters with it, okay? Most people think that's irrational behavior, so to speak. But the ones that understand the demands that you put on yourself and the goals, you know, I look at the end result. I look at things like, picture a railroad track going on forever, and there I am at the end of the track smiling and jumping all over the place because I just walked 50 meters. In fact, my goal is this time going over, I want to see if I can do 2 full revolutions with it. So that would be 100 meters.
Mm-hmm.
That's my goal. But I always look at the end result of everything. But, you know, I think the people that really understand what you're doing, and I think people like that underdog, you know, like we talked about, you know, like Rocky Balboa or Cinderella Man or any of that stuff where, you know, these are working class people that whether they hit it or not by what they're thinking, their dreams or goals, how hard they want to work. When you tell somebody that, a lot of them do admire what you do. And I think a lot of people like to live vicariously through that because I think there's a lot of people sitting in graveyards right now that wish they went after something instead of people saying, oh, you can't do it, or you invent 101 ways why you can't do it. And all you do is put one obstacle up after another. And, you know, there's a lot of unhappy, sad people in the world, and they're in places where they don't want to be because they're afraid. They're afraid of ridicule. They don't have the confidence. And it's too bad because, you know, there's a lot of talent out there that we're never going to meet or discover.
That's absolutely true. I mean, you talked about with what you do that you believe that there's DNA that, you know, you were born to do this. And I think that, you know, contrary to what science would tell us, I think there's a lot to that, actually. The difference is that what does it take, where is it in one's development that one figures out that, okay, this is my passion, but I don't know what to do? Or, you know, the thought of carrying that stone, to use you as an example, with people watching is too distracting. Or, you know, to do it and, you know, you have to strive to win. You know, I've never taught anybody not to win.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the secrets of getting in the zone so that you can be and have optimum performance is to not care that you actually get there. Mm-hmm. That's a really hard concept for people to understand, but the truth of it is that if you can compete and strive to do your best and be your best, but you don't care about the result, you're far more likely to get there, because we have to get rid of that additional stress level that holds people back. You have to be able to use that stress to help you rather than push you away. You know, using that arousal level with strong men, with weightlifters, with football players, we talk about controlled rage. And the controlled rage of, you know, on the brink of, you know, of using all the adrenaline, of using every ounce of strength to pick up a rock or to take somebody's head off in football.
Yep.
But you can't go over that. You know, with what you're doing, that level is really high. And in order to be your best, you have to understand that level of arousal and control it. And that's where it becomes a skill, because it is within your control. Looking at the competition and being able to stay calm, knowing that you are confident from within, knowing that you can do this in a carefree way, noting that you are motivated and driven and you understand where it's coming from. And finally, that you're focused, that you have laser focus so that you can, you know, not be bothered by anything outside of what you're doing, but still, while you're carrying that stone, know that the path, there's something in the way of the path, and you can avoid it. You know, these are the things that great athletes can do, and they're all skills, and that means they can be taught to anybody.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. This is one thing that you hear this quite a bit, and there is some of it with anything you do. The word fear. Do you encounter this a lot with, you know, whether it's an athlete that's an elite tennis player right down, and, you know, once again, we'll go back to the guy that's playing wiffle ball. Do you, when you first encounter these people, do you notice, is there a fear in them? Obviously you could tell it right when they speak to you vocally, but is fear a big issue with a lot of this stuff that's holding these people back?
Well, we have to break that fear down a little bit. Now, understand that half the people that I work with know they have some kind of issue. The other half know that they are exceptional and they want to get better. Okay? So they're tweaking. Maybe that's not quite the best word to use.
Yep,
they
right.
are adjusting to the next level of competition. There's nothing wrong with them. They can compete at a high level, but they want to compete at a higher level.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's some mental things that they can do as well. But the other part that comes in, and the question really is about fear, there are really three kinds of fear that an athlete comes in with. There are some that come in with a fear of getting hurt. You know, the football player that has gotten hit one too many times. Even some of the weight type of people that they know they can lift X amount of weight, but they're sure that if they go up another 20 pounds, they're going to rip something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty rare. But, you know, I would think that when they get into that level of competition, that's where they're concerned, because now they're going to go and max out. And then there's the other fears, and these are the ones that are more common. There's fear of success, which isn't too common, but it is out there. Fear of success is that people have been slapped down from becoming successful. So, you know, if you think of it as somebody in the workplace, you know, they do really well at mid-level management, they get promoted, and something goes wrong and they get fired. And, you know, they get back into another job where they're at mid-level and they get promoted again because they are that good, and then something happens and they get fired. So they start to feel like, I don't need success at that level because every time I get there, I get slapped down. Well, that happens to athletes too. You know, you see athletes that bounce up a level and then come back down. And so they're afraid to continue, and so they stop their training, so they're not ultimately successful. Fear of failure, though, is the one that I see the most. People decide that it's easier not to try because then I haven't really failed.
No, and that's true. I mean, I know when I was getting ready to go to Iceland the first time, I looked at it a little bit different. I had more of a fear. I didn't want to let anybody down. That seemed to resonate in me quite a bit where, you know, you're going over to a huge event for the first time, you know, and it's not like I'm going 25 miles to a meet. I'm going out of the United States. I'm going to Iceland. And, you know, that right there was a big deal, but I didn't really have, I mean, that was preparation like we talked about. And, you know, I did some very smart things, but, you know, when you tell people, and this is one thing I don't do as much as I used to do, you know, I don't go and tell everybody anymore, like I'm going over to Iceland to go lift a rock, because, you know, you kind of set yourself up. If something happens, you come back and it's going to be like, oh, you didn't do it, you know, and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I'd rather not even, you know, I tell a few chosen people, like, you know, I'm going to go away and I'm going to go do some type of endeavor. But I no longer go and broadcast it anymore, because I guess it's the idea, if you come back with your tail between your legs, so to speak, which I don't really even concede to something like that, but you know, most people would think that is a failure, but I don't, because, you know, I got a permanent scar on this arm, that the bicep that's been fixed of Iceland. And I'll tell you what, Mike, I couldn't be happier. That'll sound nuts to you too, but, you know, I was with a lot of big name athletes there. You know, they've all blown biceps. You know, one guy, Steffi Petersen, he's been in World's Strongest Man. He's probably maybe 26 now. You know, flipping a 1,000-pound tire, he blew the bicep literally right off the bone. So I think it was more with me, it was like you just didn't want to let anybody down, and you didn't want to let the team down. And I remember when that happened, you know, out there it's so remote. I mean, if you had something real, real major, there's a chance you're not going to live. That's just the way it is. And, you know, we got there and all that. And, you know, the first thing I wanted to do is I wanted to get on a plane and get the hell out of there and get that arm fixed. I mean, they offered there, they were fabulous. You know, everybody knows who's who in charge in these hospitals. They did the testing, you know, obviously gave me what I needed for any type of pain, which I really didn't have any. And I wanted to go home. And then I started thinking, you know something, I'm part of this team and I can still do things. I mean, if they need to be driven, you know, whatever. And I stayed for the whole duration of it. And I'm glad I did, because I would have regretted leaving there, because I think no matter what happens, unless it's something major, you stay with your team, you support your team, you stand behind your team. But there was that part of me that felt like I had let them down, because, you know, like anybody, when you're out in the middle of nowhere and you're lifting a 600-pound column stone, and it's something, unless you've done it, I don't know how I could explain it to you other than think of the greatest thing you've ever done and how good you feel. And it's like you've got this shit-eating grin from, you know, ear to ear. It's incredible. So that's what I dealt with there.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And that's why, you know, but now you can see how fear develops in an athlete. that fear of failure, that fear of embarrassment. One of the things, and in sports psychology, we never used to talk about this. In fact, it's still not written about very often, is that fear of failure really comes from shame. And I work with a lot of athletes that have some level of shame that detracts from what they do. And it leads to this fear of failure. You know, somewhere back in Little League, some coach yelled at them and said, you should be ashamed of yourself for striking out. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, a teacher said something to them and they match that up with being ashamed. And now they come and they're trying to achieve something at that next level. And whether they're successful or not depends on them being able to go all out. And they know somewhere inside them that if they fail, they're going to feel that level of embarrassment, of that level of shame. And it's something that I work with athletes to get past, because it automatically opens them up to be able to strive to do what they want to do, what they love to do. But that's where that fear of failure comes from, is that association with shame. When you were there and you had to make that decision, do I go back or not, you did it for the team, and that allowed you to not feel bad because you realized what was more important. Not every athlete can do that because they want to, you know, tuck their tail between their legs and go home.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, like the old saying, I'm sure maybe you've heard this, if not, a good insult, like we were talking, whether it's a coach, a teacher, some mentor that, or an older person you look up to, as they say, a good insult will last a lifetime. And that's very serious stuff, because especially in today's world, I think things are a lot different. I mean, we had 5 kids in my family. Obviously, I told you about my brother Jim, who had muscular dystrophy, was wheelchair bound, who this whole thing really came about of a few things with FBC. And like I've told other people, when I talked to Amanda last night too, I don't take health for granted. I never have. And I think one of the reasons was because of watching Jim. You know, here's a kid that we took everywhere with us. He was matriculated with all the other kids in school. There was nothing wrong with his brain power or anything like that. And I remember, you know, whether we took him down to the park for organized little league baseball, or we were throwing stuff on the street with football, or over the, you know, the regular park by the house. I used to look at him, Mike, and I would say to myself, how the hell is he doing this? And happy guy, you know, you never heard like, why me? None of this stuff. And I said to myself, it's got to be hell sitting there watching everything, but it never seemed to faze him. And I'm sure he knew it, and he had to want to get up like any other little boy or girl and move. And I think, you know, I know my other 2 brothers have been weightlifters. My younger brother does a little boxing too, you know, biking. He's a maniac like that. And my sister's a black belt in karate. So I know that this had a level of influence on all of us, whether, you know, we've talked about it, but not in any detail, because it does get everybody a little upset, but it doesn't really upset me. To me, it was a tick up. And, you know, Jimmy is with me all the time, and it's like, and I think to myself, and I've got a picture in my garage too, where everything is. I've got a picture of a guy doing incline presses that was in, obviously, the last few battles we've had overseas. He lost both of his legs, and he's got, you know, basically steel legs. And I'm saying to myself, how dare you come out here and say you're even tired tonight or you're sore? And there you are looking at a guy that's given everything he's got, and he's got both legs just blown right off him, literally. So I don't take anything for granted now. And I know that the window with Iceland and all these other things, you go another year, It gets a little bit more hectic, a little more dangerous probably at times. And, you know, we're trying to create a big business here and all that. And you know, we just want to just keep going forward. So, you know, I think those things matter. And I think they are like a sum of many things in your life, and how you rise to them and not let them control you in a negative way is very essential to your progress.
Well, you know, I heard this at a conference I was just at, and I've turned it around a little bit, but let me ask you this.
Sure.
Can you sing?
or not bad. Not bad.
How about this? Yeah. Can you draw? Are you an artist?
Not an artist, but I've always been told by people my signature and the way I write is
all right, so,
very artistic. So
can I have you do a painting? You're going to stand out on the street, and we'll put $5 on it.
Yeah, okay.
Are you up for something like that?
I
mean, if we were to ask most of the people you know, can they draw? What would they say?
They would probably say no.
Okay. If we were to go back to when they were in high school, you'd probably get a few more saying yes, right?
Mm-hmm.
If we were to go back and ask them when they were in preschool or kindergarten, can you draw?
They'd all jump up with their hands high as can be.
Right. So somewhere along the line, they learned not to be an artist.
Mm-hmm.
Because when they were in kindergarten and preschool, they were all artists. We were all artists because nobody had told us you're lousy.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody told us. I mean, I still remember a kindergarten teacher telling me I could never be an artist. And that, you know, I should try harder because I should be ashamed of that paint that thing I was drawing, because I drew bodies that were triangles instead of rectangles.
Stickman.
I don't know. But for whatever reason, she was really adamant. She's just like the I just blew his name. Not Tom Chapin, but
Harry, is it?
Harry Chapin. The song Roses Are Red.
Mm-hmm.
You know, somewhere along the line, through circumstance and development and friends saying things and teachers saying things and parents saying things and coaches saying things, we develop to be the people we are.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that means believing that we can't do something.
Well, I also think the word no is used very – I think the word no can really stifle. I've watched it around kids and stuff. I think that's another thing that kind of stifles progress. Obviously, that you do have to use the word, but I do see that used over – it's way overdone, I think. And I also think, too, I this is one thing I've wanted to ask you. I keep forgetting to ask you. You've been doing this for a long time. Do you see the athletes, say, of the 70s to the athletes now that we're in 2014? Was the mental toughness a lot different back, say, 35 years ago? Or have people, you know, I hate that word, evolved, but, you know, when I watch, like, the old NFL clips, you know, and you'll see these guys like a Dick Butkus or, you know, anybody of that era there, John Riggins, those guys, they just seemed tougher to me. And, okay, you know, right, when you see a guy,
let's,
go ahead,
let's,
I'm sorry.
Let's, all right, so I've got this, is better for video, but I just pulled out my magic wand.
Okay.
It doesn't work, but I pulled out my magic wand, and we just pulled Dick Butkus from the 1960s, the best linebacker in the NFL, maybe the best linebacker in history. And we take him as a 27-year-old linebacker, and we pull him from whenever he was 27 and we put him into the NFL today, okay, we just pull one to the other. Now, we're not going to change training. We're not, you know, he's not magically evolved to a player who was born in 1990.
Yep.
He's the same guy. He doesn't survive today's NFL. The players are so much faster, so much stronger. The mental toughness is different in the sense that back then it was the strong, only the strong survived.
Yeah.
Well, we have ways to help some of the weaker players survive today. And you're not, you know, I'm here in Seattle. You might have heard we won a Super Bowl.
Sure you did.
And Pete Carroll is a different kind of coach.
Yep.
You know, he's not going to scream down your throat and belittle you. That's the kind of thing that made those guys tough. They were the guys who could survive that. And by attrition, people didn't survive.
Right.
Today, some of our better athletes, they never would have made it. I'm going to take a guy from today and put him back in the 60s and 70s. He wouldn't have survived either, even though he's bigger and stronger, because maybe he can't handle the culture.
Okay.
So things have evolved and things are different, but what it's allowed is for a different kind of strength to come through. It's allowed for somebody who is physically gifted, but just needs to be talked to in a different way. I mean,
gotcha.
Everybody back then, and you remember this, I mean, our coaches came out of the military. They came out of World War II and Korea and Vietnam, and they were DIs. They were the guys who, and that's where a lot of the physical education thing came from. So it was like, stand at attention, do everything I say. If you look at me funny, you're going to do 100 push-ups.
Right.
And people didn't survive that. I mean, today, I look at the high schools and I look at what their physical education programs are, and they have been diminished to where you have to take one semester or 1 year out of 4 years. And it's that way because of what our past was. Because it wasn't entertaining. It didn't lead people to want to do fitness the rest of their lives. It convinced them that they didn't ever want to pick up a weight ever again or do a calisthenic ever again. You talked to me yesterday about the program that you want to do for young kids so that they're into fitness. The problem was back then that we made it a military kind of thing. We made it a do as I say. You know, don't ask – when I say jump, you don't say anything but how high, sir. And we turned people off. And so today, people don't want to continue. They don't want to keep doing it. Now, we have thousands and millions of people doing fitness. Don't get me wrong.
Right.
But there's so many more people out there that could be doing it. But we don't have the programs anymore in the schools to do that. The most successful – I took a poll here in the Northwest. You know what the single most popular physical fitness – or not physical education classes today?
What's that?
Yoga.
God.
And I'm not saying that yoga is bad, but I'm saying that – people are taking it for different – they're not taking it for the yoga reasons. They're taking
Correct.
It for other reasons. But the other classes, they don't want to learn those things because we've enculturated the whole program as being one that's not for us. So that's a really long way of getting around talking about that mental toughness question. Athletes today are mentally tough. They're just not mentally tough the same way that they were back there. I don't require – you don't – I mean, you don't eat nails And you do some incredible strength things, but you don't eat nails like you would have had to have done 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 30 years ago, we put rubber suits on people and made them run out in 90-degree weather so that they could drop weight. And did that do anything other than kill some people?
Not much.
So they were tougher in a different way, but we eliminated so many more people from participation because of that. Today, I mean, we have more kids playing sports today. Unfortunately, they don't continue, but that's a different story for a different time because we're not interested in this country in development. We're interested in winning.
Right.
And that's the problem with youth sports. But we have more kids playing sports today than we ever have.
Well, I think, Mike, with that, too, is like I see, you know, because my brother-in-law is a high school football coach. And you see the mothers and fathers and the people in the bleachers, and they're like rabid animals. I mean, they don't want to hear anything about their kid, or, you know, they're out there trying to coach from the bench, and it's scary to watch it because, you know, let's say what, maybe 1% is going to make it to the big dance, and they all think that, you know, and that's being a parent. You have pride in your kids, but some of this stuff to me is very irrational in behavior. And what are you going to do to this kid psychologically too, when basically he crumbles right out there on the field or suddenly isn't number one anymore? What have you done to prepare him for that? And then I guess, secondly, I want to say this, I guess one of my favorite coaches, the great Vince Lombardi, probably would not be today's head man. And would I be correct with that too?
You know, I want to say that Lombardi, for his time, was an innovator.
Definitely.
And those with innovation change.
Right.
So I think that there is a possibility that he would be different today. Now, there are other coaches that I'm convinced otherwise. I had an athlete recently go compete outside of Columbus, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And so part of her team went, and they were at another college, but they went over to Ohio State to tour the campus because she's from a small campus in Southern California. And I said, so – yeah, I think you can go over there. And the one thing I don't want to see, though, is I don't want to see a picture of you with Woody Hayes. Because Woody Hayes, when I was growing up, Woody Hayes was everything I hated about coaches.
Yep.
And, of course, she sent me a text photo of the statue of Woody Hayes. But so Woody Hayes would never have changed.
Mm-hmm.
Lombardi, I think, was a little bit different because I think he was an innovator. Woody Hayes came out of that strict discipline mode. Lombardi, I think, knew some other things. I don't know. I mean, it's hard. I've been coaching, you know, besides doing sports psychology, I've coached soccer for 35 years.
Mm-hmm.
I played soccer in college a little bit, and I played, like I said, part of a year professionally. But I teach 13-year-olds to do moves with a soccer ball that I couldn't do back then.
Mm-hmm.
If I taught soccer today like I had learned to play soccer, I couldn't coach recreational soccer.
Mm-hmm.
But not every coach I've met changes. Not every coach I've met evolves. Most of the coaches that I know, even at the premier level of coaching high school and club soccer, they still coach the way they were coached. It takes a lot to move forward. You know, I like to think that I coach soccer much more like they teach soccer in Europe, because I looked at it and I go, that's cool what do I have to do that? And so I've learned. But I talk to coaches that are very successful coaches in terms of winning, and they don't do that. They're still kicking the ball long and having people, the fastest athletes, run onto them so that they can score, because winning is the only thing that matters. Mm-hmm. And development doesn't count. And we need to focus on development. And it's even with the kind of work that you're working with people, it's development. It's not about just winning. It's development and moving step by step.
Yeah, it's basically, you know, I'll use this analogy. It's a business plan. Like I told you, I think I told you yesterday, we've got 2 years set up right now for this business with the launch, where we're going, what we're going to do, and at least the end result for the middle part of 2016. These are all things, you know, this is the way I've always done stuff too, especially when I was in information management and building systems for these big IBM mainframes. There's a certain sequence of the way you do things, and they have to be planned out, and they have to be pretty much right on the nose with everything, or you have failure. And I mean, you can still have failure. Different things come from these companies, and you know, you might have to put a fix on something to get it to go or whatever, but the majority of times, this stuff is pretty precise. I mean, this is their end, this is their bread and butter, and they know that we have to perform for these companies, or they're not going to bother with us anymore. So I've kind of subscribed to that now with everything I do. Obviously, I've always been that way with training because, you know, fail to plan, plan to fail. I mean, that was a thing when I was in college. I had professor named Mr. Klein, and I had him for all of my business courses. And to this day, I mean, that was one of the verbiage he'd say constantly. And he was very involved in semi-pro football. So I took to him, you know, like a duck to water. He loved all that weightlifting stuff. And, you know, he's one of the guys that you could really talk to and joke around with. And, you know, you could kind of talk very frank with him. And this is, I think, a way you've got to be. I think, you know, like when we talk about Lombardi, I think he could have made it today, because I'll tell you one thing. Not only was he a people's coach, he might have been brash on the surface, but he loved those men, and those men loved him. I've read many books by, you know, like Jerry Kramer, and I got this mainly from my dad. I mean, I wasn't even around when they were winning, but to see these men go out, and most of them have been very successful, not only personally but professionally, you know, this is what I believe that a lot of people need. And I applaud you for, you know, your tenacity with this. You know, I wish you could have made it to the pros, but, you know, in another way, you've been blessed with the ability to go out and take what you call as failures and teach people a whole different way to do things and to become successful. So maybe you failed, you feel you failed on some things, but you look at the big picture, it was probably good it did happen to you, because you took that failure and look what you've done with it. Now you've turned it into not only a successful business, but you've gone out and you've touched lives. So I think that's the most important thing.
Well, you know, in retrospect and looking at things today, which is the only way we can look at things in the
right
present, then absolutely. I mean, I could have done a lot of other things with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, maybe I should have. However, when I look at the wall up here, which I only started collecting pictures recently. You know, I was in Southern California for a conference last month, and I'm working with a young woman who's in CrossFit. And I was introduced to her because when I was doing a radio show, I was interviewing her father, who I had only talked to once in 30 years. But I had helped prepare him for the Olympics in 1980, the Olympics that never took place.
Right.
And he found me on the internet a couple of years ago, and so I invited him on my radio show, and she listened to it. And so she calls me, and we talk about her training, you know, about once a month. But I was down in Southern California, and we arranged for me to meet up with him. And so we're in a coffee shop, and she brings him in, and I've got my back turned to him, and they're talking, and I turn around, and he looks at me, because he has, I mean, he's seen my picture on the internet, but, you know, unfortunately, I'm no longer the skinny kid that was 22 years old when I worked with him getting him ready for the Olympics.
Sure.
But he recognized me right away, and it was one of those moments of, you know, here I'm working with a second-generation athlete, mm-hmm. 35 years removed, and I thought that was pretty cool.
Absolutely.
And to be remembered that well by him, I mean, he's telling his daughter right then he should have spent more time doing the stuff with me than the stuff mm-hmm. he was doing on the track, and maybe it would have kept him from getting hurt, and maybe it would have taken him even to another level. But he retired soon after that competition because, well, they took the Olympics away from him and there was nothing else for him to do.
Yep.
So.
Well, the nice thing is, obviously, you made your mark on two lives. And, you know, this stuff the mental game is so important. I mean, we know that. And before we're just about ready to finish the show, obviously, you know, I'd love to have you back on again, Mike. And, you know, we can talk off air here when we're done because I want to throw a couple things at you. Before we get off, why don't you give everybody, unless you have anything else you'd like to add, or I don't want to interrupt you if you got something else you'd like to tell everybody.
You know, there's a couple of things that, and then you can ask me that other question about how people can find me. But
you got it.
There are a couple of things. One is if everybody would remember that to get in the zone, they need to be calm, confident, motivated, focused, and play the game, whatever that game is, in a carefree manner. That doesn't mean that they don't care or that they're not striving to succeed. I mean, if we were playing tic-tac-toe, I would play to win that game.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I never teach anybody not to play for everything they have. But to care about the result really takes you out of that zone. So those are the biggest things. I should say also that I have a book available called The Athlete Within You. It's available on Amazon. It's also available through my website, which is www.thementalhyphengame.com.
And I looked at that yesterday, Mike. That's something they can digitally download too, right?
Yes, they can get a Kindle version on Amazon, and they can email me and get a PDF if they'd prefer that.
Yeah, because I mean, I'm finding that more and more that people are going that way. Obviously, because of what we're getting into this month with the weight loss MP4/DVD. Is there anything else? You gave your website. Do you got any big events coming up or anything that we could tell the folks out in Muscle and Motivation and Muscle Land?
You know, I don't have any big events coming up right now. There's some things that are in the works, but they're a little bit unplanned right now. I am a professional speaker. I'm a professional member of the. I was going to say the NSA, but people take that the wrong way. of the National Speakers Association. I do a lot of corporate stuff, and I'd love if somebody's out there listening and they'd like to hear some more of this stuff and how it really, really does apply to what they do in their business, then they can contact me through either themental-game.com or Mike Margolis, that's margolies.com.
Okay.
And, of course, they can, and my phone numbers are on there as well.
Okay, very good. With that in mind, I'll give you a few things with us. This is Motivation and Muscle, the podcast show that connects your brain to your brawn. And we mean that when we say that. You've just heard Mike today, and obviously your brain has an awful lot to do with what you're going to do in your life and how far you're going to get. And I don't think that can be impressed upon anyone enough. Second of all, we are www.fiorellobarbellco.com. That's co.com. We can be found, obviously, on Facebook, Fiorello Barbell. We are on Twitter at Fiorello Eric. We can be reached at Fiorello Barbell at nycap.rr.com. That's nycap.robertrobert.com. We're also on Stitcher and iTunes. And as I'll say to you, Mike, as I say to everybody, you and I are being heard all over the world. This will be posted. This show should be posted Wednesday. We've got a couple others. We just put up a big one with T-Rex Bank, and so you'd love this guy, Mike. He's a strong man. He's very involved with Ronald McDonald House and things of that nature. He gives an awful lot of time, and he does all the old stuff. He blows hot water bottles up till they explode. He tears. He'll be in a wrestler's bridge and tearing a phone book in like three major strips, breaks baseball bats over his thigh, breaks chains with his throat, does a lot of bending, and besides that, he's an all-around great guy. And he's going to be a big part of this show, I think, down the road, too. And I think that's it. But, Mike, I really enjoyed you on the show, and come back anytime you'd like. I'm sure there's a ton of stuff we could get into with all the mental game, obviously. And that's about it. So, you know, Mike, thank you, and I appreciate your support with this. It was great to have you on.
Thanks a lot, Eric. I'd love to come back anytime.
Okay, that's great.
It's fun.
So for Mike Margolis and Eric Fiorello, this is the end of the show. And have a great week, and look forward to the show. We'll have it posted up not only on our blog, but it will be out to all the social media. So thanks, everybody, and have a great week.
You're listening to Motivation and Muscle, the best podcast connecting your brain to your brawn.